I'm Dimae Roberts, Stage and Studio. We're listening to music by Portland musician and composer Joe Kai. Hear his music at joekai.com. Today we're going to hear three different stories from Portland theater artists. The stories were recorded for the We Can Listen series, Spotlight on Equity. It was presented by the Old Church Concert Hall and was recorded by Darren Oberg and hosted by Jane Vogel of Advanced Gender and Equity in the Arts. The topic was, why do I keep having these difficult conversations? Demarginalizing the Margins, a Spotlight on Equity in Theater. The three artists are Damaris Webb, co-director of Vanport Mosaic, Rusty Tennant, the artistic director of Fuse Theater Ensemble and the Outright Festival, and Yasmin Ruvalcaba, who is the community engagement coordinator of Advanced Gender Equity in the Arts. And now we join this talk that took place on October 16th. Hosted by Jane Vogel.
So in setting the stage, what we're going to do is we're going to start with each of the artists to talk. Some of what you hear might be uncomfortable, it might be confusing, it might be not in line with your experience, but whatever it is that you feel, I hope you'll lean into the discomfort and that you'll listen with curiosity and respect and openness. Next up is Damaris Webb. Damaris is an international theater maker as social justice advocate. Her work lives in the intersection of contemplative dance, improvisational performance art, and contemporary theater. She is co-director of the Vanport Mosaic.
When we talk specifically about the theater, and I consider myself been really wrestling with this as a theater maker as social justice advocate, instead of and, it's as, yeah. That for me, and I mostly grew up here in Portland during a time when Jefferson High School had a dynamic performing arts program and we were given tools to have opportunity, which I'm super grateful for. And I know that when I did my undergraduate work at the Experimental Theater Wing at NYU, and I was just speaking earlier that in my entire career, including my graduate program at Contemporary Performance Program at Naropa University, and I'm super grateful for all of my training and the wonderful teachers who I've had the privilege to study with, but I saw in all that time 1.5 people of color as my teachers. And there is that break or some disconnect between seeing, I mean, my father would never go to the movies and I would ask him why and he said, well, I just don't see myself there. Why would I go, right? And so there's this catch-22 of, well, how am I going to show up if my stories aren't being told? And when you talk about opportunity, I have had several opportunities to play a slave, to play a house servant, to play an ambiguous other in a Shakespeare play, etc., etc. And well-meaning production companies and others will offer me parts in these sometimes interesting roles, but they're not my stories, right? At a certain point, I get tired of being A, the one who gets lynched, or B, having to be the various other, right? I want to tell my stories. I want to have the opportunity to do that. And let us also remember that when we say the theater, there are many, many theaters around this world. There are many, I had an argument with a friend the other day where I'm like, with the exception of maybe David Bowie, I don't need to hear any more old male musicians, white male musicians. I just don't. Not, you know, I mean, there's beautiful, I love Queen. I mean, great music out there, but I've heard it so much. I am tired of having white men shoved down my throat. That's what I said. I've gotten a little bit of argument about that, but there is so much, you know, and I'm sure I'm kind of preaching to the converted here, but I feel that if you embark on this, well, let me see if I can, for the next 6 months, only read female writers or only writers of color, and then you find a few more, and you find a few more, and you find a few more. And soon you find there's this whole world that, for whatever reasons of convenience, have not been offered. You know, and as a theater maker that comes from a somatic training background, my great desire as a human and to offer to other humans is a full range of possibility and expression. And, you know, as I'm sure we all feel at various times in our life, we get about this much of it most of the time. So even for any other reason than to celebrate the possibilities, right, and the histories. And I am tired of coming up against fear. I'm tired of coming up against fear. And I'm tired of coming up against the fear that a lot of production companies have that their audiences aren't ready. And, you know, so because of that, even in my undergraduate, during a time that I came up, there was the Bill Cosby show. So Lisa Bonet was like maybe the only option. And happily for me, I went to a program that gave me tools to make my own work. So that's how that whole thing started, just because what were the options there? So I will go ahead and read just a little bit from my solo play called The Box Marked Black, Tales of a African American Growing Up Mulatto with Sock Puppets. Stuart is my cousin on my father's side, loud, proud, and black. And of my first cousins, he's the closest to me in age, being only 5 years my senior. But in the late 70s, those 5 years made him wise in my eyes, with his bushy afro, thick lips, wide grin, and a gaze that mirrored his delight with the world. His skin was a shade darker than mine, but somehow, was it the fact that he had two black parents, or that he sometimes wore a hairnet? But somehow, Stuart was black, and I wasn't. I remember asking him, "Stuart, what do you say when somebody asks you what's up?" "Oh, dammy, you tell him the sky. Dammy, you say the sky." My father is the patriarch of our extended Portland-based family, the eldest and only non-adopted blood-related son of my grandmother. My father was born on a rural farm in eastern Tennessee, grandbaby to a freed slave and a Cherokee. His mother was one of 11 children. Now, my grandmother, she was a teacher. She was a nurse and a Christian missionary who married a Baptist minister who brought the whole family out to Oregon to spread the word of the Lord. People say I favor my grandmother. We have the same smile, the same shaped eyes. My right foot sticks out when I walk like hers. We have the same hands, long, veiny digits, only mine are bigger. With my grandmother's hands, she baked biscuits for my father, poured him a glass of water from the tap and a cup of Kool-Aid from the plastic pitcher. She laid the table and folded them in prayer. Jesus wept. Shortest passage in the Bible, dammy. She soothed my father's fevered brow, and she pointed him on the path that she could no longer walk. Now my father, he marched with the Black Panthers. He sat at those lunch counters before the segregation lines came down, and he was in that first class at the University of Oregon that finally allowed coloreds. And he married a white woman. My mother, she was first-generation American, her father having immigrated from Helsinki and, like most good Suomalainen, putting down roots in Minnesota. In Duluth, he worked his own barbershop, the Star Barbershop, at the top of the hill on Fifth Street, where his wife, Mandy, would bring him lunch, rain, shine, or driving sleet. My mother swore by Sisu, that particular Finnish character trait of perseverance, strength of will, and equanimity in the face of adversity. I am what you might call a high yella. Maybe white enough to pass, but definitely not black enough to play Benita from A Raisin in the Sun. And even though I am half Finnish, no one is casting me as Miss Julie. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is going to be Rusty Tennant. who is an actor, director, and educator, artistic director of the Outright Theater Festival, a celebration of the LGBTQI+ contribution to theater that is held annually in Portland. Rusty.
My name is Rusty. I'm going to do a little selection of a solo show that I just created. It's called The Importance of Being Frank. There are a couple things you want to know before I get into this. Number one, Shakespeare was a poet who wrote a bunch of queer poetry to another man. 126 sonnets, definitely, possibly 154 if you want to get really semantic about it. Okay? That's 126 sonnets. And the other thing you need to know is that my mother was born on April 23rd, which is Shakespeare's, the day that Shakespeare was born on, as well as the day that he supposedly died on. And she took me to see my first Shakespeare play, A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I fell in love with the role of Puck. I was about in fifth grade at that time. From 1594 to 1609, Shakespeare wrote his sonnets. That's 15 years, a decade and a half, to create a single creation. It should at least give us pause to realize that maybe this wasn't intended to be a single creation. You see, the sonnets read much more like a queer diary than they do actual real poetry, right? Where the words like guilt and shame appear almost as often as the word love. And before we all jump down this rabbit hole together, a couple things I'd like to make clear. Number one, sonnets are written for one specific purpose. Love, not friendship. 'Twas always thus, and always thus will be. It was a structure. It was a given, especially in Shakespeare's day. And the only other sonnets that we know of to be written about, notice I said about, not written to another man, but about the love of two men, are Barnfield's 20 quote-unquote certain sonnets called The Affectionate Shepherd. And they tell the story of the love story of Daphnis and Ganymede. Ganymede, the name that Rosalind takes on when she dresses like a man and goes into the Forest of Arden to woo another man. To quote from The Affectionate Shepherd, "If it be sin to love a lovely lad, then O sin I, for whose song my sound is sad." Sin. Another one of those words that appears all too often in Shakespeare's sonnets and, quite honestly, all too often in my life. Number two. It was not more okay to be gay in Shakespeare's day. Though foppishness and effeminacy were less identified with homosexuality, because the word didn't exist yet, it was still illegal in the numerous ways that we have always made homosexuality illegal, like sodomy laws, or homoeroticism laws, or pederasty laws. We don't make the people illegal. We make their necessary actions illegal. Sonnet 36. Let me confess that we two must be twain, although our undivided loves are one. So shall these blots that do with me remain, without thy help by me, be born alone. In our two loves there is but one respect, though in our lives a separable spite, which though it alter not love's sole effect, yet doth it steal sweet hours from love's delight. I may not evermore acknowledge thee, lest my bewailed guilt should do thee shame, nor thou with public kindness honor me, unless thou take that honor from thy name. But do not so. I love thee in such sort as thou, being mine, mine is thy good report. This is not pride. This is shame. This is guilt. He says it right there for us. This is shame and guilt so strong that the poet William Shakespeare decides that he must give up his one and only true love because of it. Shame. My mother never knew I was gay. Correction. She likely knew I was gay. They always do. But she very definitely made it clear that she did not want to know I was gay one day when she sat me down, and I'm going to do my Midwestern accent now, and said, "You know me. I love everyone. Always room in my house for anyone. But if there is one group I will never understand, it is gays." It still hurts to hear her say that. And no matter how hard I try, I can never stop hearing that. A little context, because context matters. My mother really did exhibit love for everyone. She was crazy. She took in a homeless person when we were kids. She took in a young couple who needed to live, who got married and couldn't live with their family anymore because they weren't living as Christian as they wanted them to live. And so my mom took them in. She really loved everyone. She did this while still giving as much love as her three boys needed to them. My mom and I were close. I identified with my mother. When my brothers would go off hunting with my dad, I would stay back and cook with my mom. We loved to go shopping together, whether it was grocery shopping or clothing shopping. Either way, there was probably a treat in it for me. So, and it was my mom who defended me when my dad, Teeter, caught me playing in her clothes. Teeter, he's just playing. And defended me when I would cheerlead with the high school cheerleaders. Teeter, look at all those people paying attention to him. I was not there to see my mother pass away. I was about 20 minutes too late. I walked in, and I saw what my future had in store for me. It was my dad, my brother Brian, my other brother Kenny, and it was a wall of masculinity. And my only connection to my femininity lay dead on the other side of that door. In an irony almost too painful to handle, at the time of my mother's death, I was playing Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream. I walked into that dark hospital room. And the only light was the fluorescent glow of a reading light above her head. And she was a bluish green that exists in no other place in nature besides death. And I recited Puck's final monologue. If we shadows have offended, but this, and all is mended, that you have but slumbered here while these visions did appear, and this weak and idle theme, no more yielding but a dream. Gentles, do not reprehend. If you pardon, we will mend. And as I am an honest Puck, if we have unearned luck now to scape the serpent's tongue, we will make amends ere long, else the Puck a liar call. So good night unto you all. Give me your hand if we be friends, and Robin shall restore amends. So I posit this not as a scholar, but as someone who studied a little bit of Shakespeare in my day. I posit this not as a psychologist, but as a queer who thinks a lot, maybe too much, about the question, why, damn you, Stanislavski? And what if the reason that we know so little about Shakespeare is because they knew too much? What if he was erased, scrubbed from history, shamed from his livelihood, ostracized from his community? Puritanical conservatism was a powerful force in Shakespeare's day, and an even more powerful force after his death. And what if T.T., Thomas Thorpe, the publisher of the sonnets, figured out he got his hands on a sure bet, huh? And what if a jealous lover to whom all of the sonnets were written, maybe the only begetter of these ensuing sonnets, what if that lover handed them over as blackmail? Because the sonnets themselves are evidence that this relationship did not end well. And did you know the first publication of Shakespeare's sonnets sold out so quickly, a second pressing was immediately ordered? That never happened. It was unheard of in this day and age for something like that to happen. They literally could not print them fast enough. And yet not a single copy of that original edition could be found for nearly 200 years after Shakespeare's death. We have pieced together his plays like puzzles from various different papers and quartos and folios. His life is such a mystery that it has moved beyond biography into various different accounts of plausible fiction, like this one. And for a man known as a playwright, we only have three different samples of his handwriting, three differently spelled signatures on some random legal documents. And now, we're not even certain how many or how much of his plays he actually wrote. This from a man who was highly regarded in his day, from peasant to royalty, as the greatest playwright of all time. History is a lie. And we agree to it. So what if the Puritans finally had their kill switch, huh? They'd closed down many of his plays in the past for reasons of immorality, but what if they could now prove his immorality as a sodomite? What if they could destroy his reputation? Because, as my Lord and Savior Hannah Gadsby says, if you destroy the man's reputation, well, then you destroy the man. What if the reason Shakespeare left London and lived in relative isolation after 1610 is because he had been ostracized by an ever-growing and well-intended social movement, claiming its moral authority? And now, the hard question that's just been rattling around up here the past few weeks, how close are we to doing the same thing to our own artists? Don't we all at least have something good to offer? And are we willing to erase people like the Puritans? Because they burned every remaining trace of Shakespeare that they could find. They decided to reorder the narrative of the sonnets. And they went through and they changed all the references to the young man, changed the gender on all of the pronouns. Literally straightwashing the document. And these are the sonnets that we knew until the mid-1800s as Shakespeare's sonnets. For nearly 200 years. 200 years is a long time to forget. So what if we really didn't understand Mark Twain when he famously said, Shakespeare's sonnets, this is my cis-hetero white male, by the way. Shakespeare's sonnets are something that everyone wants to have read, but nobody wants to read. Because, like Tom Cruise in that movie where Jack Nicholson is just a lot better actor than he is, maybe we can't handle the truth. Thank you very much.
And last but not least, we have Yasmin Rubalcaba, who is the Community Engagement Coordinator at AGE. She is a recent graduate of Williams College, where she challenged the lack of diversity by directing plays written by Tanya Saracho, August Wilson, and Louis Valdez.
Hi. 3 years ago, I was starting my junior year of college, and I was torn between becoming a lawyer and becoming a professor. Surprise, I became neither. But there I was writing a paper for one of my classes. It was about my mom's border crossing experience. It was academic. It was revolutionary. I was so excited, and I sent it to my sister. She's 2 years younger than me. I was like, hey, read this, tell me what you think. And she was like, it's a little academic. I don't really understand it all. She's like, but overall it looks good. And it was that moment that I realized that here I am writing a story about my mother and her experience, and she would never be able to read that. My family, you know, wouldn't, my mom speaks English, but even then, that was a paper that wasn't meant for her. It was meant for academia, it was meant for the elite. And that's when I decided that I didn't want to go down that path, that I wanted to find a different way to tell those stories, that I wanted to engage with those people and actually give them that space. So today, I wanted to share a monologue from the play that I'm now workshopping with the Northwest Theater Workshop and Milagro Theater called My Mother's Shoes, and it's based on my mom's border crossing experience. And for this, though, I would like to invite a special friend, Karina Ramirez Valesquez, and she will be reading the monologue for me.
We walked and we walked and we walked. For the longest time, all we could hear was the cracking of the tierra beneath our soles. It seems our feet were longing to have a conversation with Mother Earth, and I felt the need to shush them. Calladitos, se ven más bonitos, piececitos. Then out of nowhere, the chupolines would decide to harmonize. They would pick up right after the step, mixing in with the echo, adding the whoosh of the wind. Is anyone hearing this? No? Come on. We have a banda following our shadows. The rhythm is enticing. It makes me want to dance. Chalio, chalio, come and dance. Baila conmigo. It seems the serenata isn't meant for my lindo marido. Ay, qué bonito. Wait, do you hear that? Do you hear it? The song. It's a little different. I hear a deep gurgle that's slowing down the melody. It's the bass of the song. It's majestic. It's longing. It's water. The river. El río. We made it to the river. Oh, I lived near a river my whole life, but this river, ay, qué río tan bonito. This beautiful, untamed beast only meant one thing. We were close. Oh, we were so close. I swear in the dead of night, I could imagine the border on just the other side of the river. I could feel the energy building in the group. Everyone is whispering, hope returning to their tired eyes. After hours and hours of wondering, one can't help but wonder if we were to simply continue following our footsteps until the end of time. Ya llegamos, Talio. Ya mero llegamos. No lo puedo. My last words, carried away in silence by the breeze. La coyote is ordering us to be quiet, to get low. What was it? The sound of the river seemed to be getting louder, but that wasn't it. It seemed to be coming from somewhere else. There. It's a humming slowly rising from behind those. I can barely make out some hills. Yes, hills. I can see them better now. There's a flash of light. Oh God, there's a flash of light. It's illuminating the trees against the black night. From a distance, it seemed the trees were people caught in the middle of their journey, arms raised, asking for mercy, reaching up the skies, pleading to the migra. But we come so far, too far to get caught. No, we must remain calm. Calmaditos. Respira. Respira. They don't know we're here. They haven't seen us. Oh, but it feels like I was beckoning them with the beat of my heart. Cállate, corazón. Not now. Don't run. But I want to run away from them, towards them. Give up? Be free? No, we can't be caught. Not now. Not here. We have to split up. We can't stay together. Talio, no me dejas. Don't leave me. Not now. No, don't go over there. Please stay here. No me sueltes. No. ¿Y ahora qué? What do I do? The bush. I have to go hide under the bush. Stay low, stay quiet, and don't draw attention to yourself or anyone else. Hide under the bush. I swear the helicopter heard the rustling as I crouched, as I made myself small, invisible. It's moving towards us. Here I am, face to the ground, my heart racing, barely breathing. I keep imagining the light landing on me. The light is getting closer, the blades cutting up apart the river song that I heard only moments ago. The gushing of the water mixed in with the power of the helicopter, and somehow I still found myself alone in a soundless hell. My voice was scared and my thoughts hid. Suddenly, my thoughts revoked their vows of silence. What if it comes closer? What if I open my eyes and I see that my body is being caressed by the light? What could I do? Where could I go? I imagined throwing myself into the river, trying to get away, trying to make it, unable to hold my breath, gasping and swallowing water as I fight the current that tried to take me back. I imagined the light sweeping over the river as I'm forced to pull myself under to not be seen. I imagine the helicopter pilots playing a game, keeping the light on the river for as long as possible, knowing full well that someone was down there hiding, dying in hopes of making it out alive, of making it to their future, slowly letting go of my final remaining breath, feeling the rushing of the water as it enters the void in my body that wasn't inhabited by hope, getting heavier and heavier, joining the restless souls of simply seek release. No, that's not me. That can't be me. I'm not in the river. I'm not dying. The light hasn't consumed me. I need to stay calm. My face to the ground, I begin to pray, a silent prayer. There are no thoughts. There are no words, only a dream of moving forward. I'm scared. All the times before that I uttered those words, I now knew the true meaning. I feel like the dark sky is simply consuming my prayers, or the river is dragging them down the street, not allowing them to be heard. But suddenly, everything seems to become silent. I can still see the helicopter marching through the sky, but I hear nothing. Then I hear it, a whisper, a gentle, loving voice. I'm here, and I knew she was.
This is Stage and Studio. I'm Dime Roberts. We just heard theater artists Yasmin Ruvakaba, Rusty Tennant, and Damaris Webb, each talking about their work for the We Can Listen series, Spotlight on Equity in the Arts. It was presented on October 16th by the Old Church Concert Hall and recorded by Darren Oberg and hosted by Jane Vogel. For more info about the We Can Listen series, visit theoldchurch.org. I also have that link as well as the artist info and the podcast of this show at kboo.fm/stageandstudio and stageandstudio.org. That's it for Stage and Studio. Till next time, I'm Dime Roberts. We're going to go out with more music by Joe Kai at joekai.com.